You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on 3rd of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, there may be no universal solution to dealing with the so-called Islamic State, but could Tunisia's rocky political road hold some clues? One political candidate says yes. Meanwhile, despite calls from the US and its allies to uphold a peace process, Russia continues its bombing campaign in Syria. Plus, South Korea warns the North of a harsh price should it push ahead with plans to launch a satellite. And could Italy's far right be on track for a comeback? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Alistair Bunkle, defence correspondent for Sky News, and the author and commentator Geoffrey Kaufman. Welcome to you both. Now, there is no shortage of people in agreement that the current strategies against the so-called Islamic State are perhaps proving less effective than many had hoped. Rashid Ghannouchi is the co-founder and president of Tunisia's Muslims Democratic Party, and he says a more localised response that proactively targets the core of the group's origins is necessary. ISIS has masterfully exploited many of the Middle East's problems to portray itself as a viable alternative, but Mr. Ghannouchi says the fight against ISIS must be not only a fight against something, but also for something. And Geoffrey Kaufman, in a sense, he's right, isn't he?
Of course he is, you know, and I think that, you know, you look at Tunisia, which is perhaps the only bright spot where we have actually seen some sort of flourishing since the Arab Spring. And you have unemployment officially somewhere around 40%. I mean, ISIS is simply exploiting a huge weakness in both the economic hope and opportunity of a rising generation, and also a legacy of oppression and lack of basic human rights and opportunities. And of course, you've got to offer something positive. I mean, it's a bit apple pie what he's saying. I have to say, it's, you know, it's kind of obvious, but it is true. You're not going to erase ISIS simply with bombs, because in many ways they have the opposite effect.
And Alistair, you know, when we look at what's happened elsewhere in the Arab world over the last 5 years, there has been a distinct lack of, let's say, sort of a political openings for different groups that have something they want to put across. There's been very little in the way of democracy, really.
There has. I mean, that was the genesis of much of the so-called Arab Spring. I think, you know, where I'd completely agree with Geoffrey is that it might sound obvious, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it is something that has been grasped or followed through by the politicians and diplomats trying to find a solution to this. And they must realise that Islamic State can be bombed into submission, but it's the ideology that will prevail. And a few years ago, Islamic State no one had really heard of, but Al-Qaeda we had. And if you get rid of Islamic State, it's what might pop up in its place. And that's why you need to look at a wider strategy to foster prosperity, foster economic growth, jobs, the sort of concerns that people around the region have that lead them to take action.
Geoffrey.
Two points on that. When I was in Libya, when Gaddafi was killed, I remember after he'd been toppled, remember, in August, a few months later, he was found and killed by Libyan rebels. I remember having a very interesting conversation with a Libyan expatriate, and she was talking about trying to build civil society in Libya. And I said, so if if I said I'm Bill Gates and I've got all the money, and boundless money to help Libya do that, what would you do? She had a very an answer that really picks up on what Alistair's saying. She said, I would build recreational centers. I would build places for young people to have a positive way to express themselves, to burn off energy, and to create community. She said, there's nowhere to do that in these countries. There's no equivalent to a basketball court or a cricket pitch for young men to go to gather. And it's very true that in a funny way, something like basketball diplomacy is to pick up on what Alistair's saying. It's so obvious and seems almost silly, but in many ways, I think she's right. People need to feel a sense of community that isn't based on anger. And let me just pick up on the anger point. One of the issues that comes out of these repressive regimes is that when the imams get up in the mosque and there is so much anger traditionally against these oppressive dictatorships, they can't speak out against the Gaddafis or the Assads, but they can speak out about the West and its evil ways with impunity. And that is a way for them to gain power, to gain credence, and to be sanctioned by the government. And so it feeds on itself, these two things. One is this ethos that sees people encouraged to foment hatred towards Western values. And another is offering no alternatives.
Here's the problem then, Alistair. We can all sit around here and agree on what needs to be done. Why is it that there's only in Tunisia where you have a political party with some power that's willing and able to say this? Why aren't we seeing this elsewhere within the Arab world?
Well, I mean, firstly, let's not assume for a moment that Tunisia is a perfect example to follow, because it is not. It has its own problems. Jeffrey mentioned its high unemployment rate. It has terrorist issues as well, as we've seen over the past 12 months. But talking about the wider region, as your question addressed, I sense that there is a movement to start addressing these problems now that probably didn't exist 18 months ago, maybe. So we've got the Syria conference in London tomorrow, where a lot of the money that will be pledged will go towards not just where you'd expect it to, humanitarian aid, food, medicine, clothing, shelter in refugee camps, but also to what they're calling the intelligent solution, if you like. So making sure that people who leave Syria, leave Iraq, are still funded to continue in the careers that they have held back home, so that when and whenever it might be, they feel free to return back to, say, Syria. They haven't been out of society. They haven't been living a dead life for the time they've been away. They have managed to progress and continue. And that is to make sure that quite quickly you could create something of a society after the downfall of Assad.
Now, Ghannouchi can say all this because he's elected, because Tunisia is a democracy. But if you were sitting in Egypt right now, Jeffrey, you wouldn't have the situation where you would have an elected politician saying we must do something for the people, we must create more jobs, because their democracy lasted less than 2 years.
Yeah, and I think to answer your question earlier, there are historic reasons why Tunisia is closer to to a positive outcome than any of the other. I guess there were, five players in the Arab Spring. Libya, a totally dysfunctional, broken state, really run tribally and kept fractured by Gaddafi. Egypt, the biggest country in the region, 90 million, desperately poor. Syria, in its balkanized, oppressive form. And Yemen, which is just, on the fringe. So, Tunisia is a French colony, has Tunis itself, a highly cosmopolitan city, an educated class.
It had trade unions, political parties.
Very northern looking across the Mediterranean to Europe, much more so than any of the other nations. So I think there's a very clear historic reason why. But as Alistair rightly says, we wouldn't want to, despite, this kind of conversation, these kind of articles, take it too much to heart. And I would say also that you referred, there were three horrible terrorist incidents in Tunisia last year. And the reason, I think it's very clear, is that ISIS knows that if it can destabilize, create higher unemployment, it has an easier time picking off the young. The more Tunisia approaches some sort of stability, the more it's in their interest to try to destabilize.
The young are the most likely to become disaffected.
Yeah,
the young
completely.
Are the most valuable to ISIS. They are the best fighters. They're the ones that are more likely to seek or have the willingness to try and seek an alternative elsewhere.
Right. And you take all those hotels in the island of Djerba, those all-inclusive hotels for British and German and French tourists, one of which was the site of a huge massacre, many of the dead British tourists. it's fair to say that business is not very good there, which means a lot of young people who had menial jobs but paying jobs have lost employment, and that feeds into ISIS and the instability.
Do you feel, Alistair, there's been too much emphasis so far on the military front, on how ISIS is defeated on the battlefield, rather than, and also to extent, you know, ideologically as well, rather than saying, okay, how do we help those who are fighting them politically? How do we make sure that economies are strong?
I was joking with someone from the Foreign Office last night, actually, that next week you'll have a meeting in Brussels at NATO between defence ministers working out the next steps or the strategy for the military campaign, whilst at the same time, concurrently over in Munich, the Vienna group, the diplomatic side of it, will decamp to Munich ahead of the security conference and speak about a political solution. So you've got the two running side by side. But the point of that is that they both are necessary. ISIS will not be defeated through political terms, but Syria requires a political solution nonetheless. Now, the hope is that you find some sort of solution to Assad, you find some sort of agreement to his immediate or delayed departure, and you galvanize a lot of the forces that are currently opposed into creating some sort of cohesion force to fight Islamic State. I mean, I still have my reservations and doubts about that, but nonetheless, that is the political thinking at the moment. But as that goes on, and these diplomatic processes can take a long, long time, you have to have a military strategy that is containing them. I'm not convinced that is working either, though.
Well, let's move on to Syria. And as you say, political strategies do take a long, long time. And just before we came on air, the UN announced it was suspending peace talks aimed at ending Syria's five-year civil war. Jeffrey Kaufman, the UN saying this is a temporary suspension. They feel that not enough progress has been made in the first few days. But it sends a pretty worrying signal, doesn't
terrible.
It? Because let's face it, no one was expecting this to be an easy task.
This is, I think we all have cause for despair here, because, you know, as Syria goes, so does the regional and then global stability, I think, right now. And I think, you know, no one is surprised by this. Listen, the Russians clearly and Assad clearly wanted this to happen. You know, the Russians have dropped something like 500 bombs in the Aleppo region over the last couple of days. Syrian forces loyal to Assad have broken through and pushed back the opposition forces. The opposition are feeling like, you know, how can we talk to these bastards? And so it's not surprising that there's a huge amount of animosity. Putin's fingerprints are all over this, and through him, his proxy Assad.
I think Russia's calculation is that you want to enter the talks with the strongest possible hand, and so if you increase the intensity of your bombing in the days and weeks leading up to the talks, it puts the opposition on the back foot. They have less steam, less impetus in their movements at the moment. So their negotiating position from the word go is reduced. And that is what Russia has sought to do. I think that some of the main supply routes into Aleppo have been cut off in the last 24 hours, thus annoying the opposition quite considerably. I think it's the opposition that have called off or have been probably the source of the suspension of these talks. But I don't think it'd be fair to point the finger solely at them. This is a circular game here.
Exactly. Well said. Because in fact, I think it's very clear if you look at this beyond the headlines, this allows Assad and Putin to say, oh, look, the opposition walked away. But in fact, it's that they provoked them. This is what they want. They want to blame them and say, well, we tried. We were there. Look, we had nice hotel rooms and some nice meals. But, you know, they didn't want to talk.
Explain to me, why do people walk, people who are losing a war, why do they walk out of peace talks?
To strengthen their hand.
But does it, though? I fail to see how it strengthens your hand to walk out of peace talks.
Well, I don't think it's I think it's also there's emotion. There's just raw emotion.
Yeah.
You know, how can I look you in the eye, you so and so, when you've just bombed my home, you've just carpet bombed my community, killed my relatives. I mean, I think it's just, you know, there's a huge amount of emotion here that is very easy to understand, and that, you know, it's hatred, it's distrust, it's contempt, all of those things.
When we look historically at peace talks, they tend to work when either one of two things has happened. One is when there's a stalemate and, you know, really no one can move on either side. The other is when someone has pretty much won,
Well, I mean, I can't think of a, I can't really think of a since the Second World War, really, of peace talks where someone has clearly won when you've had protracted peace talks. You look at Northern Ireland, for example. They took years, and that is when you had some pretty well-defined groups with which to negotiate with. ISIS, obviously, are not don't fall into that category, and hence why they're not a part of these peace talks ongoing in Geneva and elsewhere in Vienna. But just to quickly come back to what I was saying about why you walk out the room, the parties all have to be in the room for an agreement to occur, whenever that agreement might happen. There will be a lot of walking in and out of rooms, as there was during the Iranian negotiations over many, many months and years. The opposition will walk out of the room. I completely agree with Jeffrey, because of emotion, because they cannot handle or they cannot stomach what is being done to them. But they will also know that they will need to be persuaded to come back into the room. And they will want to be persuaded to come back into the room, but they will want concessions or whatever it might be to come back and join the talks.
And this is the problem that the opposition have, Jeffrey, isn't it? That while Russia very certainly has Assad's back, does anyone really have the opposition's back in quite the same way?
Well, I think that, you know, the problem with the question you asked previously about historical parallels is that you know, you can't think of this as a, you know, the Treaty of Versailles. These are not nations that with even if discredited with leaders, you know, as you saw, you know, after the First and Second World War, that had some sort of legitimacy to their role. These are fractured groups. You know, this is a constant theme since the Arab Spring. Just because you lead and just because you're the big guy doesn't mean that anybody will follow. And you know, I think that this was a problem with the Palestinian negotiations with Arafat. You know, that's probably a better parallel. And look how successful they've been. You know, these are disparate groups. They don't have discipline. There is no way to force people to follow you. So you know, I think that's the complexity here. And Steve, your question hits on a very important point, which is that a lot of these opposition groups have now been discredited. There ain't no good player in this anymore.
Is that true, though, Alistair, or is it that the West doesn't have someone that it feels comfortable backing?
I think both are true. I think we're looking at the least extreme extremists at the moment. But, you know, who else? Probably is the answer to that question. I mean, if you're not going to get behind some of the more moderate elements of the opposition, then who are you going to get behind? Because whatever happens, they need, out of the back end of this, to create some sort of force in which to take on ISIS.
I suppose the Dayton Accord might be the closest parallel, the disintegration of Yugoslavia and the Balkans War and, you know, the disparate groups
there's
there.
There's a parallel with, and it's not a good one, but with Darfur, in that you had a government which, you know, eventually was charged with genocide by the ICC, much good that did, and you had rebel groups which were, at some stage, there were more than 20 different rebel groups, none of whom the West seemed that happy to back completely. And that didn't lead to any accord whatsoever. Alistair, when we look at where this ends up, again, to look at historical parallels, normally peace deals have been struck when you can sort of work out beforehand that there is a sort of, there's a vague picture of what a peace deal might look like. I struggle to find anyone who can give us a vague picture of what a realistic peace deal here. Everyone's got their own fantasy of what it might look like, but a realistic idea of what this might turn out as.
And you're asking me to provide one?
No, I'm not saying to provide one, but like, does that seem to you like to be a big problem here?
Oh, a huge problem. I think, I mean, that I would completely agree with you. I have never come across anyone who has presented to me the solution to the Syria conundrum. Let me say a couple of things. Firstly, I think Russia, and this is fairly obvious, but are key in it all. They can turn it on and turn it off quite quickly, and when they want to push for a peace solution and when they want to finally push for some sort of political trajectory, then we might see some sort of progress.
And Russia more important than Iran?
Yes, I think so, because their forces in the country are dominant at the moment. I think the Iranians have, after some initial progress some time ago, have really kind of struggled to make much of a mark in the country. And I think really Russia are the big foreign player on that side of things. I wouldn't completely bet against some sort of breakup of the country, but I think if that's going to happen as part of a process, we're a long way away. But, you know, when you brought up the Daytona Accord and the former Yugoslavia and the success that has happened subsequently with the breakup in that region, it's not unthinkable that they could look at something similar. But I think that then opens up a new can of worms, because then you're going to have the Kurds saying, "Well, we want complete autonomy up in Iraq."
And Turkey won't be very happy.
But is that, Jeffrey? You know, to look ahead 25 years, where we're heading with these are countries that were artificially put together in the first place by people who weren't from the region. You know, maybe they shouldn't stay artificially together.
25 years is so far in the future. It's hard to see 2 years in the future. But I would say, I guess, Steve, when I think about it, 25 years from now, I think it's a safe bet the borders in that region will not be the same. 5 years, I wouldn't say. But the Kurdish desire for autonomy is not going to go away. And as these countries disintegrate, there will be more openings. But I'm not inherently pessimistic, but I just don't see this being resolved. And everything we talk about around this table, we read in the newspaper that Alistair, I suspect, focuses on Sky, all of the big stories come down to this: immigration, global instability, ISIS. It's all about the consequences of the destabilization caused by the Arab Spring and that failed, which then sort of goes back to the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, and then I suppose we can say George Bush and Tony Blair, but quite seriously, it does. This is the dominant root cause of all of the major stories right now of our time.
We're going to have to leave it there on that point. Jeffrey Kaufman and Alistair Bunkle will be with us again after this break.
Monocle has bureau around the world in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Singapore, our bureau chief is Nolan Giles.
I think the most exciting thing about being based here in Singapore during this period of such rapid growth for Southeast Asia is the energy of the professional community here. So you have this Singaporean mindset of ambition and of hard work and of punching well above its weight, mixed with a community of people from outside the country that have come here to add more depth, to bring their knowledge, to bring their culture and their understanding.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, Alistair Bunkle and Jeffrey Kaufman. Tensions between Korea's north and south are never too far from boiling point. As if the world needed any reminder, warnings were again exchanged this week after the North announced it plans to launch a satellite into space. South Korea says that any such act would result in severe consequences, while Japan placed its military on high alert. Alistair Bunkle, on the scale of 1 to Kim Jong-un, how worried are you by what's happened this week?
Right now, not overly. I think, calm heads are needed. My concern is that North Korea is headed in the right direction, and there seems to be a lack of international agreement as to how to stop it, particularly between Beijing and Washington, who are the two sort of big players. Washington, because I think probably the end goal for Pyongyang is to find a ballistic missile that has the ability to reach the west coast of the United States. And America is public enemy number one in North Korea. Beijing, because they are really the regional string pullers there. They're the ones who can just about rein in the North Koreans, although I'm less convinced of that right now.
And Jeffrey, often we talk about South Korea and we talk about Japan, and they're the ones that respond publicly and talk about what they're going to do and what they're fearful of. But Beijing is the interesting one, isn't it? Because it has been, it's been helping North Korea out financially for a while. It's been helping North Korea out politically for a while. And yet, as Alice just suggested there, it's getting a little bit wary of Kim Jong-un. And it's also a bit wary about the possibility of North Korea collapsing, because it doesn't want South Korea with its ideas of capitalism and particularly those troops and American troops in particular on its border.
Well, when you dance with the devil, it is getting to a point of at some point this is going to crack. But this kind of swaggering, it seems kind of harmless. This is a rogue state that, as long as it's contained, only its people suffer massively, and the world seems to be okay with that. The question is, does it foment instability regionally and globally through the madness of its regime? And that's what we confront every time we have a story like this.
But on that point from Jeffrey, Alistair, that the world doesn't maybe care so much about the North Korean people. Part of the reason why the world perhaps cannot is because it does have nuclear weapons.
Well, I think, if you compare North Korea to some of the other big problems, there is a number of reasons why I think it doesn't quite rank up there. And some of these are justified and some of them are not. Firstly, it's its geography. So you're surrounded by the sort of, the eastern side of Russia, which is barren. China, well, can look after itself, frankly. And then you've got South Korea, which is an American concern, really. So much of Europe and the West, It's not going to be within reach of a nuclear missile, and kind of we can look at it and laugh a little bit, and the slightly funnier side of North Korean life. The other thing is that it doesn't pose, other than this potential nuclear threat, which let's not downplay, but it doesn't really pose an existential threat outside of its borders. It's not seeking to create an insurgency elsewhere within the region or elsewhere within the world.
It's not interfering in Indonesia or fomenting revolution
in
Laos.
You don't get North Korean inspired terror attacks, for example. And so that can keep it off the agenda. And then a lot of its evil is behind closed doors. That's coming from, and I've been to the country, and you can't see much of the poverty. You cannot see the labor camps.
It's even behind closed doors when you're there itself.
Pyongyang is a relatively prosperous place compared to the rest of the country. You get glimpses of poverty, but poverty that probably in that kind of part of North Korea is comparable to other third world parts of the world. So it is not in that particular part of the country, it is not extreme poverty. It is not and you don't get anywhere near the labor camp. So we can't see it. It's very hard to have anything tangible to see how evil North Korea is. And I think those are the reasons why at the moment much of the world is happy just to sort of watch on a bit.
Jeffrey, can you see that changing much? Because if you look at the pattern, even over the last 10, 15 years, there's been, okay, we'll have some talks, or okay, we'll impose sanctions. And aside from when there was the famine in the 90s, on the whole, we've sort of accepted this sort of circus of, it's a bit crazy and we get a little bit scared, but that's it.
Well, there was another clown who ruled a country for four decades, Gaddafi from 69 to 2011. And he was a little bit of that, of the Kim Jong-un ilk. He was such a bizarre, eccentric character that people were able to laugh at him. But in both cases, those eccentricities mask true evil. I think the fall of that regime is going to come in a similar way. It's going to either come from some sort of internal uprising, coup, something that throws him off, or they're going to overstep themselves, and the West is going to say, or including South Korea and Japan are going to say, no, now you've gone too far. I mean, clearly, if they actually launch something at Japan, South Korea, the U.S., it won't take long to see some sort of retaliatory strike, and then it's an open game.
But that's the problem, though. So when we talk about they might launch something,
I'm saying that is to me the second scenario, that something provocative and completely ill-considered. And of course, it's the people who are suffering suffer more. But nothing lasts. None of these dictatorships last forever. None of these regimes.
And as to when it goes, it might crumble very, very quickly.
I think it would crumble very quickly indeed. already in South Korea. They're looking at the kind of model to follow. They've been looking at the German model, actually, and how you would go about managing a collapse of that state. And I think the current thinking is that you wouldn't unite North and South Korea immediately. You would hold it at arm's length, partly because of the economic demands it would put on South Korea as well. And so it'd be a fascinating and quite dangerous time.
We'll leave it there. Alistair Bunkle, Geoffrey Kaufman, thank you both very much. That's it for today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Ilana Hanukov. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Carlotta Ribello is here next. Then it's Danny with the entrepreneurs. Midori House, back same time tomorrow, 1800 in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening.